when I closed my Patreon that night, the way I did it was I was on a live stream and I said, for, I can't remember the exact numbers, but I was like, for every 1,000 subscribers we get, something like that, live while I'm on air, I'll do a shot of Patron because I'm leaving Patreon. Anyway, about 12 shots later.
12,000 subs. Like, it was wow, nuts. You must have been.
So I was, and I was really doing it. So not only was I wasted, but I doxed myself live on air.
Oh, no.
Because when I went finally at the end of the night, when I went to delete the account, which we were showing.
It had your address. Oh, no.
You press delete and then your email pops up.
Oh, no. Oh, your email. Great.
Wasn't my address.
This Week in Startups is brought to you by Squarespace. Turn your idea into a new website. Go to squarespace.com/twist for a free trial. When you're ready to launch, use offer code TWIST to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Northwest Registered Agent. Starting your business should be simple. With Northwest Registered Agent, you can form your entire business identity in just 10 clicks and 10 minutes. From LLCs to trademarks, domains to custom websites, they've got you covered. Get more privacy, more options, and more done. Visit northwestregisteredagent.com/twist today. And Lemon.io. Hire pre-vetted remote developers. Get 15% off your first 4 weeks of developer time at lemon.io/twist.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to This Week in Startup. Dave Rubin's going to be with us in the second half of the show. You know him from The Dave Rubin Show and Locals. Voice of the Right. Lots to talk about with him about the media business, but we have a full docket. I gave Lon some time off here so we can just ping pong and volley back and forth through this docket a little bit faster than we normally do because there's a lot going on, Alex, and we
so
need
much.
To get through this for our audience. I know Chime is going public. Explain what Chime is. Explain the deal.
All right. Chime is an American neobank, which means that it's a digital software service that is banking-like things. It is an incredibly well-funded fintech startup here in the United States. And its valuation went to, I think, about $20 billion back in 2021. And Jason, we've been waiting for this IPO for a very long time, given its scale of value, how much money was put into it, the number of investors. And finally, it's going to go public. So do you want a quick rundown of the numbers?
Yeah, I think it's always a good idea. And this is, you know, absolutely fantastic. We're tracking M&A and we're tracking IPOs. So on the IPO train, eToro is filed. Yeah, were going to go out.
eToro priced last night, Jason, and it's currently trading and it's doing well.
Oh, so eToro is out. That's the Canadian version of Robinhood.
Yep.
Then there's Chime going public. Mm-hmm. And did we have any other IPOs this year so far that we've been tracking?
Well, we're taking a look at Klarna, of course.
Klarna, right. Okay.
And StubHub is in the wings. Turo pulled back. Of course, CoreWeave went out earlier this year. So that's our current kind of list of things. But there are people keep telling me, Jason, that there are so many companies in the pipeline. So I'm expecting, given that eToro priced above range, sold more shares, and is trading well, and we're seeing Chime list, I think we could see quite a few more offerings unlocked shortly.
Got it. So here's what I want. Just as we get going here in 2025, IPOs by month. We record them, we put it in the docket so that we can kind of track this and the velocity of it and M&A above, you know, some minor amount, let's say 50 million or more. Just so we're kind of tracking this on a monthly, quarterly basis for our audience. All right. So Chime is like Mercury Bank. It's like Ramp. It's like that category of neobank. Nubank is the other one, and Nubank for South America. These are extremely popular because Bank of America and other online banks are terrible.
Garbage.
Right. And this is a really important lesson, I think, for startups. Banking seems like the most difficult group to go after, right? Like, how could you possibly take on big banks?
Yeah.
It turns out they are amongst the most hated. So one of the great ways to make a startup is to look at the index of which companies are least trusted, Alex, and most hated. When you find companies that people feel abused by, it's really easy to construct a better product. Now, they might try and stop you. There's regulation, et cetera. But if you were to look at the drug companies, they're hated. And what do people love? Compounding pharmacies and cost-plus drugs. People hate the cable companies and cable modems. What do people love? Starlink. So this is a tried and true model. People hate when there are monopolies that are captured. And my Lord, if I'm Bank of America, I've got to be a little bit nervous because I was talking to a group last night or I should say yesterday, we had our first Founder Tuesday here in Austin. I'm trying to get this whole in-person thing going. So we had a dozen founders here. We spent the day with them from 10 to 4. We got some barbecue at Stubbs in the middle. And I was amazed. They all use, you know, Mercury Chime, Ramp cards. They are rabid consumers of this vertical.
Yeah. I'm a Chase customer in my personal life, and I used to have a Citibank account back in the day, but I moved out the, you know, Northeast, not out here. Citibank decided, Jason, to start charging me a monthly fee and then won't let me close my account unless I send them like a notarized letter. That is the level of customer service that you get from existing banks. They're terrible. Now, Chime is riding the way that you outlined. So in 2024, revenue, $1.64 billion, up 31%. And that's a faster pace of growth than they saw the year before, 27. So Jason, a little bit of revenue acceleration over at Chime. And also in the first quarter of this year, revenues, I think, of about 550. So we're on a plus, you know, over $2 billion revenue run rate for this company against a 2021 era valuation of about 25. Mm-hmm. Now, I can see a lot of arguments why this company could get very close to that 2021 price. I don't know if it'll surpass it per se, but then again, eToro did much better than I expected on a slower revenue growth pace. So the market does seem to have a lot of appetite for fintech products, which I think is going to throw a halo on your Brexes, on your Ramps, on your Alpaca.markets. There's a lot of companies out there right now that are in the fintech space who are probably cheering these two companies on as champions, really, for sure. Some gosh darn DPI. And that's what I want to bring up next, Jason. So who owns Chime? Well, 5% and greater shareholders include DST Global, Crosslink Capital, Access Industries, General Atlantic, Minlo, Cathay Innovation, and our dear friends, of course, over at Iconic.
What's the share price going to be? Did we see that? Or it's not?
Not yet. This is the first S1. Okay. That'll be in the first S1A. So we're dying for that. But the company seems super healthy. Really quick account creation growth, improving ARPU, you know, improving gross margins. They had a period in 2023 when they actually managed to reduce some of their costs as they grew, Jason, which is how they managed to go from losing hundreds of millions a year to something like $25 million on a net basis last year. So essentially break even, lots of cash, growing adjusted EBITDA. It's a winner.
They make their money from the transaction fees, I guess, like other credit card companies or interchange fees, like banks make money from. Yeah, they get a percentage of the money flowing through the system.
Yes, but what's really interesting is that's going down as a percentage of their total revenue.
Okay.
So the revenue mix is improving because there is a legitimate risk, and they talk about this in filing, that local laws at the state or perhaps even federal level could undercut the interchange revenue streams that they enjoy. They give a couple of examples of that. So they're also doing other things like, you know, you can pay a fee and get your salary earlier. They get fees from out-of-network ATMs. And all that added up to about 28% of their revenue in the first quarter of this year. So slowly diversifying the revenue away, but they still make a lot of money off transactions.
10 times revenue. They're at $2 billion in revenue. They're going to go out for 10 times revenue would be 20.
Yeah.
Maybe it's 12 times revenue, $24 billion. And that matches their last private company. So this issue you've heard about here and on All In constantly and the hand-wringing of the private valuations got ahead of the eventual public ones. Well, I don't know when that last round was. Did you say it was last year or 2 years ago?
August of 2021. So literally peak
zone. 4 years ago. So think about that. 4 years, they were at $25 billion. 4 years later, they're going out at $25 billion. So the catch-up to the extraordinary valuations we saw in peak ZIRP, the overhang for a fast-growing company was 4 freaking years. So that's a lot of hand-wringing. Congratulations to the board of that company and to the management team and all the rank and file employees, because 4 years of going sideways and hard work to get to the exit, it's not fun. You know, you're used to the scoreboard going up, and they had the scoreboard go sideways, but now comes this is the new starting line for them. They're going to have a public currency. They can buy other companies. They can put this money to use.
Yeah.
And it's going to raise their profile. When a company goes public, more people know about it, more people engage with it. People didn't know Airbnb and Uber in, you know, there's probably like a third of the country that didn't know about those companies. They hear them going public. Google, when it went public, it just fills in like the last third of the laggards who don't know about it because they hear, oh, this went public, and they become more aware of it. They engage with it more. So maybe somebody sees Airbnb go public. They've heard about it, but they never used it. Maybe they go from being, you know, in that messy middle of, you know, adopters of technology, and they say, oh, you know, maybe I'll give it a shot because it's public. It legitimizes the company. So if somebody didn't want to use Chime, maybe they would. eToro, They went public, priced at $52 a share, $5 billion valuation, ballpark. So that's another great one that got out the door. Any notes on eToro? All right, founders, let's talk about your website, huh? It might be a little bit of a sensitive subject. You might be a little embarrassed about it. Let's fix that right now. If you're launching something new, give your brand the refresh it deserves. You're working so hard on your company and your website looks terrible. Do what I do. Use Squarespace. It's the all-in-one platform to make a stunning professional website. And it's ridiculously easy to use. It's going to work for everything. If you're selling products, it's got all that e-commerce built in. If you're selling services, it works perfectly. And they have a new AI product called Blueprint. Want more control? Well, of course, you can choose one of the award-winning templates and use the intuitive drag-and-drop tools to make it your own. Easy peasy, Squarespace equals the most functional and beautiful website on planet Earth. Go ahead, squarespace.com/twist to get a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/twist to get 10% off your first website or domain purchase. That's squarespace.com/twist.
Yeah, just really briefly, everybody. So they dropped a $46 to $50 IPO price range. So they priced above that, always a bullish sign. They also sold more total shares in their offering than expected. So the scale of the fundraise, Jason, was larger. Now, I think it was about half secondary. So it's not like all the money went to the balance sheet, but certainly unlocks a lot there. And as of right now, as we record this show, is trading for $66.50, up 28%. That is enough of a gain that people will complain that it was mispriced, but I would say also provides enough of a cushion that it probably won't fall underneath its IPO price. So frankly, straight up, not gonna lie, this is a win. Shout out to them. I just, it feels so lovely to be talking about companies that are now trading versus companies that might in the future.
Yeah. And it's a $5 billion company. This isn't a $50 billion, $25 billion. This is the kind of IPOs we want to see. We want to see $1, $2, $3, $4, $5, $10 billion companies getting out, because that gives, you know, the public the chance to maybe ride up from $5 billion to $100 billion. Maybe sure, they can get a 20X or a 10X off their investment. And Neon is selling to Databricks. Obviously, Databricks is a public company that's done very well. Yeah, Databricks.
No, it's still private.
It's still private. Okay, yes. Snowflake's public. Databricks is remaining private. Wow.
Yeah, they spent $1 billion roughly on a startup called Neon, and I'm going to tell people what it does and a little bit about it, and not go too much deeper because we don't have that much time. It offers Postgres as a service. Postgres is an open source relational database. Jason, they took database tech, put it up in the cloud as a managed service, and are doing quite well with it. The reason why Databricks wants them is not strictly because they have cool technology, a growing customer base, and so forth. It's because in 2024, they discovered that agentic AI and what they offered had a really lovely marriage. And so they saw a lot of demand from the agentic AI space. As a result, you know, Databricks wants people to build agents on top of their stored data inside of Databricks. Kind of a match made in heaven. Yeah. The only thing I couldn't find for us today is what its last valuation was. Though I'm going to go ahead and say at $1 billion of Databricks stock, presumably not cash, investors that backed this company are going to be very happy given that it only raised like 120, 130.
Yeah. In the announcement, I saw the announcement on the Databricks page, and there was a really interesting fact I didn't think of. You know, AI agents are, they don't care about resources, right? They just want to solve the task you're doing. So they're not thinking, oh, you know, what is this going to cost you? AI agents, it says here, we're creating four times as many databases versus humans. In other words, agents are going to be like, I have some other ideas of databases we could create. I'm going to just rip. And so if you look at this chart here, it shows humans versus AI agents in October of 2024. This means people are going to spend more. And if they're spending more and they're doing more work, they're probably going to have a stickier product.
Yes.
That's a reason to buy a company like this. If people get more value from your product and you're creating all these databases, getting all these results, that means it's stickier. I was lamenting how like terrible AI is in Slack. And then people were like, oh, do you not have the upgrade? And I'm like, oh my God, it's gonna cost me $5,000 a year or something like that for a team of 20, 25 people maybe in our Slack instance. And now I gotta make a decision. It's like all this cognitive dissonance. I just hate when they make AI an upsell. But then somebody's like, oh, why don't you use, is it Glue, David Sachs's AI first version of Slack?
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, I forgot about that. You know, like I literally forgot about it because when I went to try it last time, I was like, okay, it's a little early. Let me give them 6 months to kind of get these features we would need to move over. But now I'm seriously considering moving us out of Slack because of this AI issue, it's not AI first. And I'm trying to just simply summarize what happened. So then the Notion founder reached out to me and he turned on AI in our account. I'm going to meet with him later this week. It turns out Notion will ingest your Slack or has a Slack API. And people are saying that Notion does a better job of summarizing Slack than Slack does. So that's super interesting. Then I was like, wait a second, why don't I have a desktop client? I should have a desktop item. Like, isn't this the promise of Copilot with Windows? And obviously Apple's never going to get this done, but I downloaded a ChatGPT desktop app. I need a desktop app. Somebody please let us know at TWI Startups, at mention us on Twitter X. Is there not a desktop app that will read my Slack client for me and just end run the application level and run the back end and just read all my new messages and summarize them for me? And then just, you know, on the side say, hey, by the way, you know, while you were away, here's what's going on in the Slack production room, the investment team room, et cetera. Where is that? Where is that desktop app?
Also, can that desktop app do my email too, read my email for me and like summarize them so I can quickly respond to people and just chew through it while I'm like taking a walk?
If you use Superhuman, I literally turned all this on in Superhuman just yesterday in the settings because, you know, they've been rolling it out and I'm like, I got to be thoughtful about this. But I now have Superhuman auto-labeling all my inbound email. Oh. So when I look at it, it says marketing, pitch in my inbox. It doesn't do it, but it's doing it in my other box right now. And then it is reminding me if I don't get back to an important email. So that is built into Superhuman. Full disclosure, we're the first investors in the company. Founder of HubSpot will claim he is. Dharmesh is going to claim he is because we were both investors in Reportive. And then Raul worked us both to be the first investors in Superhuman and then told us each we were the first investors. So I will take claim to that. Even though maybe he got his check in first. I don't know whose wire came in first.
I'm not going to get in between the two of you on that, but I do think if you're the first or second money into a company doing that well, you're both going to get your credit in due time.
Okay.
In the form of a check.
Fair enough. Okay, what else do we got? I guess I did a tweet about AMC or just about the movie industry and how clueless they are. You know, before we run out of time, I think that's a really interesting story. Maybe you could tee it up for us.
All right. So Jason has a view here about how the movie industry should work on bringing more people in. And AMC, big theater chain, if you don't know, also a meme stock out there. They're going to have a discount Wednesday promotion, Jason. Essentially, if you're a part of the AMC loyalty program, you get half off tickets for Wednesdays. I presume Wednesday is the slowest day of the week for movie theaters. So why not offer tickets at a discount, get more bodies in, sell more popcorn, etc. I thought it was kind of a winning idea. You had a very divergent view and you thought it was kind of stupid. And so I'm going to go ahead and bring up your tweet here because I think it somewhat speaks for itself.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think the movie industry is clueless. I might have said something, you know, a little more colorful there. But everybody has seen the example of the Epic Pass in skiing. Skiing was this dying industry. And this company, Epic, and another one, Iconic, and some others, bought a bunch of mountains, put together a consortium, and said, all you can eat. Ski as much as you like. You want to ski 5 days a year? $500. You want to ski 50 days a year? $500. And then they boiled the frog to the point at which my Epic Pass is $1,000 a year. My Icon Pass might be $1,200. And buying a ski ticket, in order to incentivize people buying these season passes, what they did was, it's now $200 or $300 to ski for a single day. Which anybody can say, you know, by the fourth day, you're now in the all-you-can-eat mode. So what do? You book a second trip. You book a second weekend, and then you enjoy it more, and then you become addicted to it. I mean, this is like all-you-can-eat fentanyl. Like, if you could come up with a system for, like, an Epic Pass for drugs, like, I mean, you'd kill everybody, but that's what they did with skiing. They made skiing into a drug for a certain cohort of people where you just get that high, you want to keep doing it. Movies have done the opposite. Movies have said, every time you want to come here, we're going to make it more painful for you. You want to buy a ticket and you bring your family of five? Great. It's, you know, it's $10 a ticket on average, $50. And you want to buy stuff at the concession stand, it's going to be $10 per person minimum, probably more like 15. So family of five, you know, if mom and dad sit it out and the kids get $15 each, now you're at $95. $95 for 2 hours of entertainment, that's not cheap, right? And so people were, and then maybe you got the Epic Pass. Maybe you go skiing for the entire day for free. Founders, if you're serious about raising money, you need to set up your business the right way. Tight is right, and it all starts with having a registered agent. Investors simply won't fund your business if it isn't structured correctly. Before a VC can wire you the first dollar, they're going to check, is your company incorporated? Is it in good standing and compliant? Missing a filing or losing your status, I mean, it's just going to be a deal breaker for the VC. It's like you're not taking things seriously. And that's what happens during due diligence. That's when a VC makes sure they're not making a mistake by giving you investment dollars. And hey, angels do this as well. And that's where Northwest Registered Agent comes in. For just $39 plus state fees, they act as your registered agent. They handle all the paperwork, they keep you compliant, and they make sure investors see you as a serious business that's worth funding. In just 10 clicks and 10 minutes, your business is officially set up and investor ready. Northwest handles filings, they protect your privacy, and they ensure that you never miss a deadline. These are the chores that you don't want to have to deal with. You need a partner, and Northwest Registered Agent is that partner. Thousands of founders trust Northwest because they keep businesses in good standing. And with their expert corporate guides, you get real support. You don't get bots. You get real people on the phone. So here's your call to action. Very simple, easy peasy, lemon squeezy. Don't let bad paperwork cost you your next funding. Go to northwestregisteredagent.com/twist and get your business investor ready today. For just $39 plus state fees, you can set up your company the right way, fast, private, and compliant. Go to northwestregisteredagent.com/twist today. So people are making these trade-offs in their mind. Then they were like, oh yeah, we need more money. So how do we get more money? We're going to add $2 to everything for 3D. And we're going to make you watch a movie in 3D that you didn't never asked for 3D. Oh, and we're going to put it on IMAX. We charge another $3. So now you're getting to $16. Oh yeah, we're going to make it a luxury theater. You're going to be able to order food to your seat. Now the $10 in popcorn and drinks went to $25 to chicken fingers, et cetera. I literally spend $250 when I go to the movies now. Let that sink in. Five people, $250, about $50 a person. I go to an IMAX. I like the IMAX theater. That's $18 a ticket. And everybody orders dessert. And so it's basically combining dinner. Anyway, if they just went with an all-you-can-eat model of $20 per person, and then maybe if it's a family of five, you discount a little bit, you get to $50 per month for a family of five. We would go to the movies two or three times a week. They could do, I believe, what the ski industry did, which is make people addicted again to the experience of going out and seeing movies. But because there are different people in the ecosystem trying to optimize different things, the movie theater is trying to optimize the food. The movie industry is trying to optimize the ticket price. The cable TV providers are trying to optimize getting these things out of theater into their streaming services to get your $15 a month. So now you got three different constituents. And then you got poor mom and dads, which you're not in this phase yet, but you will be in another couple of years, where you're just trying to do something with the kids on a Saturday or a Sunday and laugh and have joy with them and keep them entertained and you know, maybe have some shared experiences. You got four different people going in four different directions. There is only one direction. Enjoy yourself and give people a good deal. They should let the movie studios buy the theaters and then all you can eat. And Netflix should have a theater chain. Disney should have a theater chain. And they should have reciprocity where you can see unlimited Disney, unlimited Netflix if you have either of those subscriptions. Or they could balkanize it and be like Epic and Icon Pass, where some people might pick both. People want all you can eat. So two really good ideas for founders to think about today. Can you create all you can eat? There was a movie pass that tried to do it. Didn't work because they had to deal with these different folks. But Spotify did figure out an all-you-can-eat model. Yeah. Netflix did, Disney did, et cetera. So try to look at a space and create an all-you-can-eat model and see what happens. Second, how interesting would it be to find something that's hated and make it all-you-can-eat? Sometimes people hate certain hotel chains. They charge too much. I wonder if I paid, let's think of a number, for unlimited stays in a hotel. Marriott hotels, unlimited stays. A Marriott hotel on average is $300 a night, I'm thinking.
Something in there. Depends on the city, yeah.
Okay. So 1,000 hotel room nights would be 300,000. So anyway, 300 times 300 is, you know, roughly, you know, 100,000.
Yeah.
So $100,000 paid in advance, you have unlimited stays in Bonvoy hotels. And if there's availability, you could stay in another one. I would pay that every year.
Yeah.
If I was a single guy, I would certainly pay that and just travel the world. I bet you they could sell that for $150,000 a year, $10,000 a month, $15,000 a month, and make it all you could eat. Or if you said you could buy 1,000 hotel rooms for $150,000 in advance and then just use them over 3 years, people would do these kind of deals. So it's something to think about when you're approaching entrepreneurship, is to think about making people addicted to your product and giving them some extraordinary deal, which would create a lot of press around it. So maybe what the movie theater chain should do is say, we're going to sell 1,000 of these passes for unlimited for $1,000. And you can bring 1,000 for 1,000, and you can bring up to 4 people with you. I would buy it immediately. Immediately, I would buy it.
And then charge the next 1,000, 1,200 and see where demand goes, make a bunch of money, and it's free publicity. And Jason, you made a really good important point. It's going to get people back into the theaters. Right now, they're too big, they're too empty, they're too expensive, and they have fixed labor costs. So like you need to have more bodies in there. And wouldn't it be great if for once we had a good headline about the media business?
Mm, absolutely. All right, everybody. Special guest today, Dave Rubin, is with us. You know him because he's an entrepreneur. He's a podcaster, former Lib, now MAGA. I don't know how you like to describe yourself. You and I spoke. Everybody knows the Rubin Report. I don't have to drag this out here because you're YouTube famous.
Let's see how long you can go with this intro. Come on, give me 3 more minutes the top of your head. Let's roll.
Last night we spoke at Joe Lonsdale, our mutuals, University of Austin. And 80 or so students in the first class. They're all picked because they're brainiacs. They got high SAT scores, we found out. And I was like, wow, you're in town. We should talk. Because I wanted to talk to you just about the business and how your business, specifically right-wing media, it became huge.
Yeah.
And now maybe it's in a transition, but people also maybe don't know that you created Locals. And then you sold that to Rumble. So you're, like me, a podcaster and an entrepreneur.
Right. We just have reverse entry points because I was a political guy that became a tech guy, I suppose. And you're a tech guy that became a political guy. So it's a nice meeting there.
I got dragged into politics. Yeah. You were started as a comedian. I mean, I really don't – I'm not as obsessed about politics. But is it exhausting to you? Because you do 5 days a week.
5 days a week live plus however many interviews I do on top of that. And, it's exhausting. Is it exhausting?
Talking about politics and the pace that Trump goes at.
Yeah.
And the vitriol now, like you have to be on one side. You are complex. You have many, I think, characteristics of people on the left, moderates, and the right. But you live in a world, like I do, where you're forced to pick sides.
Yeah.
So what's it like to be, I guess, in some ways, loved by the right as somebody who moved from the left?
Yeah.
And then also under this crazy scrutiny where – just like I was on the left, they want you to pass a purity test on the right. And there are some parts of the purity test that maybe you pass or you don't. So what's it like and how do you manage the psychology of being under constant scrutiny, assault, and just dealing with a pace of news? Like the pace of news in tech, that's fast.
Yeah.
But in Trump politics, it's absurd.
Right. Well, basically, it's like life has become endless doom scrolling on this thing, right? That's sort of the pace of everything. It's just, can I scroll and scroll and scroll? Almost to the point where you see good things or positive things and you just don't even look at them and you're just waiting for some disaster.
Yes.
And, you know, back in the day, and people don't remember this, but guys of our age remember it. Websites used to have an ending. You'd go to CNN.com for the news, and there was an end to the page, and it would say, go back to the top. But then, you know, the endless scroll came in. And
Daily Mail. Those are some long stories.
And it just goes, and it goes, and they just pump more to you. And, you know, our brains are not quite wired to that. So first, just quick on the exhaustion part. It is exhausting, and politics is infuriating, and we talked about this a bit last night. Once you kind of know the people on both sides of it, you know how they are publicly, and you know how they are privately, and you see how the sausage is made, there's a lot of stuff that is
theatrics, performative.
Yeah, that's all of that. And then you kind of see the disconnect between how people behave in their private life and how they are publicly. All that stuff's kind of exhausting, I would say. But like you, I've built a great life doing this. So
right.
I am able, I've made it a very high priority for me to put this thing down. I do every August. I go off the grid for a month. I've done it 8 years in a row. No phone, no TV, no news.
Where do you go? What do you do?
I've done Bora Bora a couple of times. We've done tree houses in Mexico. Literally just disappear.
Disappear.
Love it. And I read a little bit.
Is the world there when you come back?
Well,
is the
that's
world
the thing.
Still there?
You think the world won't be, and you do miss things. One year I missed the Afghanistan withdrawal. I missed John McCain dying. I missed when Biden chose Kamala as VP. You miss things.
Okay, founders, let's keep it a buck. Finding the right developers is tough. It's hard, especially when you're trying to run and scale up your startup. You got a lot to do, and Lemon.io is going to save you time. They're going to save you money and a ton of headaches, and they're great at what they do. They've done work to find and vet developers who are experienced, result-oriented, and they charge competitive rates. And you also know that great developers can be hard to find and integrate into your team, so Lemon.io handles all that for you. Startups choose Lemon.io because they only offer hand-picked developers with at least 3 years of experience and who are the best of the best, the creme de la creme. A bunch of launch founders have worked with Lemon.io and they had great experiences. Here's your call to action. Go to lemon.io/twist and find your perfect developer or tech team in 48 hours or less. And Twist listeners get 15% off their first 4 weeks. Stop burning money. Hire developers smarter. Visit lemon.io/twist.
But you come back and, you know, for the first like 5 days of it, every year the same thing happens. I'm kind of freaking out. You know, my hands go into my pocket. Like, where's the thing? Where's the, you know?
And it's then, like a shadow arm, right?
No, it really is.
Like those people who lose an arm.
And you feel it.
And they reach for something with no arm.
Well, it's like, you know, I'm sure you get it too, the phantom buzzing. You
yes,
get the phantom buzzing.
Of course.
I don't really get it anymore, but it used to be a real thing with phantom buzzing that people were getting when we first had these things in our pockets. Mm. But I think by doing the disconnect that I do, this will be my ninth year doing it, that has been one of the things that's allowed me to stay sane because we know a lot of the same people and we're a lot of the same world. So many people go into the political thing with good, you know, most people do things for good intentions and they just, you know, the clicks, the fame, the money, whatever it is,
they
it just starts making you crazy.
You know? Yeah, where do you fail currently and where do they love you?
Sure.
Like, so that is psychologically, I think part of the strategy is to, in your replies, attack, you get brigaded.
Yeah,
I have had coordinated brigading. You know, Sachs has sort of made fun of it on the pod where, you know, he called off like the MAGA people. But I know how the brigading works because there's group chats
Is he able to control the people? That's good to know.
Well, no, that was the kind of
no,
the joke.
Nobody can control
But there
them.
Are
yeah.
group chats
yeah.
where
yes.
they will share a yes. Dave Rubin tweet, a Jason Calacanis tweet, a Sachs tweet and say, okay.
Go. Yeah.
And you know it when you're a super router and you have a following because, okay, this tweet just went from, you know, I think my average tweet gets 50,000 views or so. And okay, this one's getting 400,000. This one has 1,800 replies. The average one has 100.
Yeah.
What's going on here?
And it turns out that suddenly none of these people follow you. And they're like, how did he get my mentions the second I tweeted it out? You have 50 people telling you to go kill yourself.
Exactly.
Or, you know, some version of
it's
that.
It's PSYOPs.
Yeah. No, it really, well, they coordinate in Telegram and they're doing it in, I don't know if it's 4chan or just whatever these underbelly things are. But that is what they're doing. There's no doubt about
and
it.
And it does affect you psychologically if you're unaware of it.
Yeah.
And I noticed it when it came to Ukraine because I had like dictator bad, as we call it, like, hey, dictators are bad and democracies, flawed as they can be, are a better system. So just, you know, my basic operating system as a Gen Xer is like, more democracy good, less democracy bad. But man, because of Sachs and his position on it, which people couldn't understand, like, why is he so pro-Putin? That just kept coming up in my replies. And I was like, oh. This is either like, some Putin people trying to promote this or anti-Ukraine people or whatever, or it could just be his followers. Like, there's some coordinated effort here. And I was like, this actually reinforces my belief
Yeah. Well, that's
one actually makes me dig in.
Well, that also is one of the reasons that you really better know what you think and why you think it. Otherwise, you will be pushed. You will suddenly tweet something that you think is fairly innocuous or not particularly dangerous politically, and you'll get owned by these people, and it will be unrelenting, and it will go on for days. And suddenly you'll be like, wait a minute, did I really miss the mark on that one? And then little did you know that it was a bot farm in Russia, or it was out of South Korea, or it was just coordinated by the frog people on Telegram or whatever it might be. And that's why it's really important. Well, it's also why it's important that once you have a certain following, you really shouldn't pay that much attention to the to the responses, which kind of sucks in a way, because I want feedback, right? Like, of course you want feedback. That's why it's nice last night to sit in a room with, you know, 80 young people, and really, like, you could see they were really listening to us. Like, they were real. The questions were great, by the way, and some were kind of combative, which was really nice, actually.
Totally fine, yeah.
But, you know, the anonymity of this thing, the distance of this thing, it has changed us so far. How old are you?
I am 54.
54. So I'll be 49 next month. So we're basically Gen X. We're basically the same age. We're the last generation that fully grew up without this thing. We're the last generation that grew up. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Brooklyn,
In Brooklyn. Okay. Yeah. So I'm from Brooklyn originally. I grew up in Long Island. Lived in New York City most of my life. But, you know, I would come home from school, get on my bike, and disappear with my friends for 8 hours. And then I showed up for dinner, and my mom,
we were latchkey kids. And we were free range.
But we were the last generation that fully had that. And that is why I think Elon being involved with Trump has been so formative, because we needed the boomers for some reason would not hand this thing over.
Yes.
And Elon, I think, just did an unbelievable job of finally being like, hey, there's another generation here. We have some, you know, experience. We're still young enough that our bodies work.
We have some energy.
Stop with you geriatric people.
I mean, Mitch McConnell glitching on TV, and then Biden is just—I don't know—this geriocracy or whatever they call it, geritocracy. I'm like, how are these? Let them retire.
I think we would all gladly send them into retirement. So it's not about letting. It's that they, for some reason, have decided not to let go. I don't know if there's another example of this literally in world history of a generation that refused to let go. Now, you might blame us in a weird way. You might blame the Gen Xers for not grabbing it more. You know, like that there's something there. That why didn't the Gen Xers be like, no, you guys can't do this anymore. You're 87 and you're running for re-election for the 40th year in a row and all of this shit. So whether it's our fault or their fault or whatever it is, part of what's going on here that feels so crazy in the world, it's a technological revolution, right? Which we're about to have another one because of AI. But it's also just this weird generational tension. I mean, even now, as you know, I'm a big Trump supporter, but the guy is basically 80 years old.
81. He's double the age. And I said this in one of our mutuals, very public person, got really upset at me and was like, please don't say that. And I'm like, he's twice the age of the VP.
Yeah, literally. JD's younger than
JD's,
me.
JD's 39, I think.
Yeah.
So if you doubled his age, he'd be 3 years younger than Trump.
Right. And look, I don't want
to— let that sink in.
See, and the weird thing is, I don't want to be ageist, so I don't hold that against him as long as he's cognitively there. The difference, I mean, I don't want to get into the whole Biden thing, which is I was doing videos in 2019 talking about his obvious cognitive problems. I'm not a wizard. I'm not from the future. Yeah. It was just pretty damn obvious. Oddly, though, I didn't write a book about it like Jake Tapper, which is now number one on Amazon.
Great.
You know?
I mean,
good for him.
I think that might be, I know it's like controversial, but I haven't read the book yet. I will give it a listen. Might be self-aware, or it could be CYA. You could take the cynical, hey, it's CYA, you know, he's part of the media, whatever. Or he could feel like, I'm really kind of pissed off that you abused my trust. And there was this grand conspiracy, and I want to get to the end of it because I was a sucker at the poker table.
Which do you think? Because it seems fairly obvious.
It could be a little bit of both. It could be he gave them the benefit of the doubt because of pre-existing relationships and because maybe he's on that team.
Yeah.
And he's as a journalist, you know, they said like, no, he's fine. You know, obviously he's older and he stutters and he's got a speech impediment and he's had that for a long time. But yeah, he's sharp. Because when I talk to my friends, Mark Pincus, Reid Hoffman, people I've known for a long time, and even Chamath, like, when's the last time you saw him? How was he? And it was always the same thing. Like, I had lunch with him, had breakfast with him. And he was great. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't like, it's still like talking to your grandpa. It's not as quick and he doesn't understand AI, but.
That in and of itself is a problem on top of what you referenced last night related to the sundowning that they were obviously hiding him at certain parts of the day and all those things.
I mean, grandpa had a bad day.
Yeah.
You know, and Dean Phillips, I give him so much credit. I don't know if you got to spend any time with Dean Phillips.
No,
he's worth having on
by
your pod.
By the time I wanted to have him on, he had already gotten out. And then
have him on your pod and talk to him. You'll be so impressed because he's a Clinton-like.
Yeah.
He probably has more in common with you than Trump, you know, and you probably in a nonpartisan world would vote for him because he believes in, you know, whatever you're doing in your personal life is your personal life, which is, I think, a Republican position historically.
Yeah.
You know, it's your
limited
ranch.
Government leaves it to you to live your life.
Yes.
As you
like
see fit.
It's literally when I moved to Texas, was a, you know, maybe we'll talk about on when I'm on your show and I'm the guest, but you know, like. That was an American value I really cherished was like, and when I came here and I bought my horse ranch and I was talking to the guy with the ranch, I was like, hey, can I do this on my ranch? He's like, sure, ranch? You mean the one you just bought? I'm like, yeah. He's like, yeah, you can do that on your ranch. I'm like, hey, can I do this on my ranch? You know, like shoot guns or whatever. Yeah. I have a shooting range. And he's like, yeah, no, it's your ranch, son. It's your ranch now. You can do that. I was like, can I? And he's like, son, I'm going to stop you right there. It's Texas. It's your ranch. Do what you want. Don't bother your neighbors. And when the fence goes down, that's when you and your neighbor split the bill and that's when you interact.
Yeah.
It's the fence.
Yeah.
And it is like a really ingrained here. That's the fence. And when I grew up in Brooklyn and you grew up in New York, we all took the subway. You had your seat. I had my seat. You have your space. I have my space. We deal with each other. You're gay. I'm straight. I'm Irish. You're Greek. You're Black, Hispanic, whatever. We just all deal with each other. Nobody cares.
Yeah.
We all got to get to work. We're all suffering through the same you know, delay on the subway, the same bullshit we got to deal with, rats on the subway platform, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And we all just got along, but you kind of just respected each other for who you are. And it was just so beautiful. I don't know what happened to this goddamn country where everybody has to be at each other's throat over your political affiliation. Who cares? The least interesting thing about anybody is which party they're in.
Yeah. Well, I'm completely uninterested in which party you're in. I like assessing people on their beliefs and all of those things. You're completely right. I use the subway a lot as an example because as someone that lived in New York City most of my adult life and I had grandparents that were in the city that I was always going to when I was a kid. You're right. Like you'd get on the subway and it was everybody from everywhere of
United Nations. Every age
and color and background and religion or whatever. And it's not even that you respected them per se, but you just didn't get in their way and they didn't get in your way. I mean, you'd all cram in together and you'd elbow everybody, but you didn't elbow them like, oh, I'll elbow the gay guy and not the Greek guy or something. Yeah. It was just like, we're all in it together.
I gotta get to work.
And that's what the danger, I would say, of what the woke thing did to the country over the last decade plus. It started whittling us down to these very, very unimportant things, right? Like, okay, so you're Irish, fine. That means you have a heritage and, you know, okay, great. That's great. And hopefully there's probably some foods you like and traditions you have.
Sure.
And we just went to an awesome St. Paddy's Day thing in Miami. And I drank my, I'm not a beer guy, but I had a margarita that had some green stuff in it. It was fantastic. Okay. Everybody was wasted by 2 p.m. It was amazing.
No judgments.
But you don't look at somebody and be like, yeah, well, how are you going to judge? Come on. But you don't look at people and be like, all right, you're Irish. I must think this about you. You're a Jew. I must think about this. You're Black. I must think this about you. And once that thing crept into the system, it basically started shredding us apart. And I lay most of the blame on this on the good liberals. I'm not talking about the crazy progressives that did this or the Marxists or whatever. The good liberal who just said, I am so damn tolerant that I will let anyone say or do anything at all times. I will be tolerant of intolerance. Yep. And once they ushered that in, the progressive movement, the radical part, basically was like, look at these suckers. What an what I always liken it to, what I wrote about in my first book, that it's basically, I'm sure you've seen it, the original Alien movie from 1977.
Oh, incredible.
If you remember, which is the best of all the movies. Maybe the second one might be better, but
Ridley Scott, James Cameron did the second, I think.
It's just perfection.
Yeah.
But if you remember at the end of the first movie, the after the alien has now, you know, ransacked the ship, killed everybody basically except Ripley and the robot who's the doctor.
Yes.
And you find out that he's a robot, you know, replicant, halfway through the movie. Yeah. He basically is saying how he admires the alien.
Yeah.
Because the alien has no morals. It just accomplishes what it wants to accomplish.
Yeah.
And this is what I've tried to explain to people about the left, like what the modern left or the progressive movement. You don't have to like what they're doing, but you have to respect that they have basically taken over the host. They took over the country.
Incredible.
And they destroyed so much. And you could say, oh, they're all idiots and they're purple-haired morons. And okay, well, it happened
it was
on your watch.
For a time, so, yeah. I mean, I remember talking to, I think, our mutual Sam Harris about this.
Yeah.
And he was on to identity politics and like radical terrorism and fundamentalism.
He was very, very early.
Very early.
This, which is why he got so much fame at an early point of the internet.
Yeah. And he and I both lived in LA. We had the same book agent. And so we met through our book agent, and I actually introduced him to Elon, and we used to have dinner together, the three of us all the time in LA.
That didn't end well, but.
Well, it didn't end well, but I'm going to try to bridge it and bring it back. But, they're at each other's throats right now. But, you know, he had described identity politics to me, you know, as a cul-de-sac. It's like, you know, you get into this thing and you just start spinning and it's never enough.
So they've infected. I mean, they just, the amount of stuff that they have destroyed. I love basketball. Like basketball, outside of my family, basketball is my thing.
Who's your team?
So I don't even have a team anymore. And I'll tell you why. I used to have a team. I'll tell you that in a sec. But the reason I don't have a team anymore is because politics destroyed the NBA. Once they put that BLM logo on the court, and then every time I turned on Inside the NBA with Chuck and Kenny and Ernie Johnson, I was like, I'm listening to people lecture me about racism.
Yeah.
That's just fine, but it's not what I'm coming to basketball for. So if you look at my YouTube search thing when I'm doing cardio every day, I watch the same games that I watched from late 80s Lakers to the Bulls run in the 90s up to about the end of Kobe. And then it became political. My favorite player of all time is a Texas guy, actually, Clyde the Glide.
Sure.
Played for Houston, with Blazers originally in Houston. And one of the greatest moments of my entire life was for my birthday about 7 years ago. My agent just sent me, I open up my text, he says, happy birthday, and it's Clyde's phone number. And then we become text buddies since then. And I was like, that's little things that you get.
You guys beat my Knicks and Patrick Ewing and John Starks back in the day.
Yeah. Well, so Clyde, that was the 94 team. 94. Clyde was traded to them in 95. But
yes,
that was game six.
Great series.
You remember the Olajuwon just nipping that John Stark shot in game six, and that's what turned
Incredible.
The whole thing around.
Yeah. So that would have been our fan. And now it's this year might be my Knicks year.
You love that team, that 94?
Knicks, I mean, I
they
started going
so
to Knicks games
rough.
In the early 90s, and that's been my passion ever since. And I literally went to the Pistons games in Detroit.
Yeah.
Wonderful city, by the way. Yeah. If you haven't been to Detroit, I know.
I've been, not in some years.
Incredible how they've turned that city around. The people are great. And it's awesome to go to road games because I'm a New Yorker or I lived in the Valley. Like getting good seats was, you know, a five-figure affair in the first two or three rows. $10,000, $20,000 a seat, which is disconnected from reality.
Yeah.
So then I was like, wait a second. I live in Austin now. I'm just going to go to Philly. And second row or first row in Philly is like, $1,000 or $2,000 or $3,000. I got courtside in Detroit for $3,000 a seat.
Damn.
Which would have been four rows back, five rows back at the Warriors, et cetera.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh my God, it's free. And I get to see a new city. It's incredible. So if the Knicks clear Boston and go to Indiana, which will be an incredible series, I'm going to literally just go to the Indiana games.
What are they charging first row?
Probably $12. I think it's like $12 for two. You and I can go.
And you get Reggie to bring you your
I mean, literally, you stay. I stayed in the best hotel in Detroit, the Shinola Hotel, based on the watch company. Mm-hmm. Gorgeous. I was in a suite that was like the presidential suite, like 2,000 square feet. It was $400 a night.
God,
I was like, God damn it. Like, this is incredible.
I sat courtside for the first time about 2 months ago. Now I'm going to name drop for a second.
Do it.
But Bill Maher called me, said, you want to come to the Laker game?
Nice.
Sat courtside with Bill. And it was just, as someone that loves basketball, I've been to a million basketball games.
No, it's totally different when you're on the wood.
We probably went to the same games because I used to go to the Knicks games all the time, especially when the Blazers or Houston was in town. And, but to sit courtside, when you're it's right a whole and different you hear thing. The squeaking and you hear yes. all the trash talk oh, and you can literally hear the sweat fly off them and land incredible. On them. It's so awesome. If you love basketball, there is nothing better.
It's literally the greatest thing ever. And I said to myself, like, if I ever make any money, like I made a bunch of money and I was like, I don't spend it. And I talked to my wife about it and you know, and she's like, well, what do you love? And I was like, I love skiing and I love the Knicks. And she's like, well, you know, we have to spend like this amount of money per year if we're going to end with this amount of money for our daughters, like just a little, like, here's how it trails off for a 54-year-old. And I'm like, can't possibly spend that amount of money a year. Like I'd have to start flying private or something. And I was like, but I could go to Japan and ski every year and treat myself to cat skiing, which is $1,000 a day, which is pretty, you know, rich compared to just using your FPS. And I bought a ski house. And then I started sitting courtside at Knicks games during the playoffs. And I said, you know, during the playoffs, I'll just go. And I won't worry that I spent $10,000 on tickets.
Yeah.
I'll just go and enjoy it.
I mean, what's the point of having it if you can't enjoy it?
Exactly.
People feel all this guilt about success. And it's like, it's funny, before I was successful, I had a weird thing about success in some sense. Like, I don't know, I was like, as I started, because, you know, there's a weird thing about fame also. Sometimes you can kind of become famous and then people think you're automatically rich. So when I first started gaining notoriety on YouTube, I was still broke. I was making maybe 50 grand a year, maybe the first few years of doing it. And I was putting all that money back in. So I barely had a dime actually, but yet I was famous. So I'd go places and people would know me.
Now you did locals.
Yeah.
I know this because I during COVID discovered Scott Adams.
Yep.
Who started doing this local things. I paid and subscribed to it for a while because I was like, I really want to see what's going on over here. And I remember Sam Harris was talking to me. I helped him set up his podcast. And he was originally on Patreon.
Yep.
But he started doing Casper ads and whatever.
Yep, yep.
And he's like, oh, this advertising's not good because when I talk about, I don't know, radical Islam or whatever, you know, priests and Catholic Church issues, they're going to drop me. Yep. Or I can't have the advertisers. Oh, my God. I'm going to have to, like, have my business development people go talk to the advertisers every episode and give them credit. So he goes to Patreon. Then he's like, oh, my God, Patreon starts kicking people off.
Yep.
And he's like, okay, I'm going to roll my own. And he kind of rolls his own subscription service. Yep. And he's like, this is the way I'm going to do it. And you did locals.
Yeah.
Great domain name. That's like a $500,000 domain name. How much did you pay for that?
About $500,000, actually. But it turned out that one of our investors, a guy by the name of Andrew Condru, who's an old tech guy from, he's not that old, but I mean, he was like one of the original tech guys from like the 90s. He had it. He had it just sitting there.
Amazing.
So originally he licensed it to us. He was an investor, but licenses to us. And then eventually when we sold the company,
Why did you decide to do a startup and then?
So it's very connected to what you just described right there. I was on Patreon, just like Sam, Jordan Peterson, a couple other people, and then they started banning people for crazy reasons. One of the reasons was there was a guy by the name of Carl Benjamin, who's big British YouTuber, and he went on, not on his Patreon account, not on his YouTube show that was being funded by Patreon. He went on someone else's show and he said the N-word, but he didn't say it to be racist. He was mocking the alt-right at the time. So he was basically playing out a character and he said the word. Without any warning, Patreon blew up his channel. That was it. They didn't send him a, you have to retract this, you have to delete this, blew up his channel. That day, I was on tour with Jordan Peterson. We were both making a night. I was making most of my money on Patreon
tour.
At that point.
No,
Jordan was already had been selling books and on tour and whatever. I was on tour with him making a nice amount, but most of my, I was making about 30 grand a month on there. That was basically the budget for my show. And Jordan and I sat down and we were like, this is intolerable. We got to figure out something. Jordan and I then tried to do something together, but that was right when Jordan was getting sick.
Remember, he had that year where
he really got quite ill. And then I was like, all right, I'm going to try to do this on my own. My brother-in-law is an Israeli startup guy, as all the Israelis are.
Yeah.
I was like, can you build me something?
He's like, 5 million.
He's like, I'm going to need 5 minutes, but I think I can do it. And basically—
5 million people, they got like seven million startups. Yeah, exactly. Like, you got 1.2 each?
You know, they're under a lot of pressure. It's a small piece of land. They're under a lot of pressure. But basically, I said, can you build me, I'm going to leave Patreon, can you build me a subscription thing? That's it. And I want direct connection with my audience. I don't want any algorithmic nonsense. I want to own the data. I want to own the emails. I want to do it the right way because it was for me. Anyway, we did that. When I closed my Patreon that night, the way I did it was I was on a live stream and I said I can't remember the exact numbers, but I was like, for every 1,000 subscribers we get, something like that, live while I'm on air, I'll do a shot of Patron because I'm leaving Patreon. Anyway, about 12 shots later.
12,000 subs. Like, it was wow, nuts. You must have been.
So I was, and I was really doing it. So not only was I wasted, but I doxed myself live on air.
Oh, no.
Because when I went finally at the end of the night, when I went to delete the account, which we were showing.
It had your address. Oh, no.
You press delete and then your email pops up.
Oh, no. Oh, your email. Great.
It wasn't my address, but, okay. But my personal email popped up, which then, of course, was problem, blah, blah, blah. Long story short, we delete that. And the next day, I was like, wow, I have a success here. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, I want to spawn this off to other people. So Scott Adams was one of the first two or three people we brought on board. We built it for him originally the way we were going to do it. And I think this is how you and I got in touch.
Yeah.
Originally, what we were going to do was white label it to people.
Yes.
So you would have your own app. Because I remember you.
Yeah, I was thinking about it too. I was like watching that area and I was like, this is a super interesting area. I want to invest in it or start something. But then, you know, one of the things that happens is, as you know, if you figure out advertising and it takes off, like this podcast, I've had 14 years. I was one of the first five podcasters. It's been sold out for 13 of the 14 years.
That's incredible.
And it was only year it wasn't sold out was during COVID, where we had maybe five advertisers, two or three went out of business, and we let two push their ads to the next year because they were like, we can't do business, so please let us push our ads back. But I just think it's such a great idea to do the subscription.
Well, so subscription, look, if you have a base of people that like you, like it's a great business. Now, of course, you're eventually going to hit a ceiling on that. But basically we thought, so originally Locals was white labeled. So I had a Rubin Report app. Then once we brought on Scott, I think we had a prototype for his white label. But then suddenly like 10 other people reached out to me in a week that were fairly well known. Michael Malice, who's here in Austin, a bunch of other people. And then
Malice is here.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, but he's part of Daily Wire now.
Is he part of Daily Wire now? Not
Michael Malice. Oh, no, Michael Malice.
Oh, you're thinking of Michael Knowles.
Michael Knowles.
Who's in Nashville.
Michael Malice is the guy who's kind of...
He's the ANCAP. I call him the Willy Wonka.
He's an anarchist.
Yeah, he's an anarchist.
But he's not a white supremacist.
No, not at all. You should have him on. He is one of the most wonderful people you will ever meet.
But an anarchist.
He's a complete anarchist. He doesn't believe in government at all.
Wow.
He's been to North Korea. Like the guy has his parents came from Soviet Russia. He's got
I probably would like to hang with a guy like that. Sounds like a good hang.
He's here in Austin. We should get drinks. Like he's a great, great human being. Anyway, I brought him on and a few other people. And then quickly we realized, all right, the white label thing isn't going to make sense there. So let's just put it all into
one app. It doesn't scale,
We do all that. And then it's really successful. I was like, holy, and then Saks came on as an investor. And really once—
Joe Lonsdale was an investor.
Joe Lonsdale was an investor. But once we got Saks, then everything else opened up. Because once we got Saks, suddenly Naval was like, I'll put in money. And Joe put in money.
Yeah,
and all these other—
It
just opened up all the doors for us. And the beauty of the Saks thing is that we were at Peter Thiel's New Year's party in Miami. I don't know, this is like 5 years ago or so.
And my invite got lost. it's a very gay New Year's.
Yeah, I guess,
I wanted to
go
to that.
For me, it was just the average New Year's, but,
I want to go to Peter Thiel's very gay New Year's party. Can I be your plus two?
That can be arranged. So we go, and this very pretty woman comes up to me, and she says she's a big fan, and we're chatting for a while. And then she says, I want you to meet my husband, David. And I chat with this guy, David, for like 15 minutes. And I was like, he's a nice guy. She was very nice, whatever. I took a picture with her. And then I walk away, and some guy's like, how do you know David Saks? I didn't even know who David
was.
Was
Jackie Saks.
Yeah, it was Jackie. I didn't know who David was. I wasn't really that, even though I was in tech at that point, it's not my world. I come from politics and comedy, whatever. The best thing that I could say about David is literally 2 days later, I called him up. I was like, hey, listen, I know we just had a quick chat. Your wife seems to like me. Mm. We had a 15-minute conversation. I showed him some numbers. He called me the next day. He's like, let's do it.
Yeah.
And then it just opened every door for us.
That's one of the nice
things.
Next thing
you know, we got acquired by Rumble, and Rumble went public. So,
nice. And you owned a nice piece of Rumble,
We sold all for stock. I did not take one dime.
Smart.
Yeah.
So you're good.
I'm good.
I like it.
I'm good.
And
but I still
startup?
Got this jacket that you complimented me on. It's like a Chinese drop ship.
It's okay.
$30.
Yeah,
pretty good.
$27 of that was the Trump tariff.
Exactly.
So enjoy it. Yeah. You don't think the Trump tariff stuff was crazy? You had to look at that and think.
No, I didn't. You can watch my videos from those days. Even when the market crashed, I just thought it was a negotiation tactic and I thought everything would be fine.
So 4D, you're in the 4D chess camp.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was just like, well, wait a minute. Is he really trying to, crash the economy? And is no country going to come back and be like, I'd like access to the American markets? That just seemed crazy to me. So I was like, let's just give it a couple of days. I did learn something about myself. Hopefully you learned the reverse thing, which is that when it comes to investing, I'm not that aggressive. Like when my guys were like, it's dropping, you should probably start buying. I was just like, you know what? Let's just kind of let it be.
Oh, no, you always buy when it's crunchy.
I know. I didn't, though. I just let it be. And look, it's all come back, right? I mean, is it even more now than
we had? No, it's exactly even since. Right. So Trump's flat, for the year.
But as I think maybe it was you or it was Sachs that said on All In a week or two ago, we'll only find out the results of this when the landing happens. And we're going to learn about that in the next couple of weeks. And if we get 40 countries that come back with better deals, and maybe we get 10 countries that –
yeah.
Let's say it's a wash and we get a few that it's not good. It still was a net good. The little pain point, as you just said, the market's back. So I just,
you know, my take on it is, like, I want to get your opinion on this about the nature of Trump.
Yeah.
You know the guy.
Yeah.
I studied him before he came on All In. I never really told this story, but I'll tell it on your podcast later when I'm on your pod. But I studied him. Major.
We're doing the rare back-to-back pod.
We're doing the back-to-back pods. Yeah, it's nice. It's a double feature.
Yeah.
But I studied him, and my perception of him is a key piece to his psychology is being respected.
Yes.
You agree?
Yes.
Like, it is a major part of it.
Yes.
And even beyond respect, being loved. Like, actually people loving him for who he is. And he's not like the perfect character. He's obviously flawed in some ways and, you know, bombastic, and people don't like his style. Maybe they love his style, whatever it is. But I just knew he would reverse all of this stuff with the tariffs if things went the wrong way, because his overriding principle is to be loved by the American people.
So do you think this wasn't the plan?
No. I think he was doing a ton of trial balloons and floating things.
But
it wasn't well thought out, because if it was well thought out, I think what you would have said is, we have 150 trading partners. We can put them into these three buckets. These ones are inconsequential because we don't do a lot of trade with them. These five are 90% of it. It's a Pareto principle. It's the power law. These five are the ones that matter. And then these are the ones in between. So I've told Bessent to do this group of people who are important. And then I'm putting, you know, Sachs and Elon, or this person and that person, Lutnick on these ones. And here's the strategy we're going to pursue. It's going to be pretty aggressive. There's going to be some pain. Here's what you can expect. Instead, it was like, oh, you put it at 50? I'm making it 150. And it was this attention-seeking, crazy, shake the globe. And now shake the globe as a concept is fine. I get the reality TV, the attention getting. You know, there's, you know, these concepts in negotiations to anchor, you know, in a crazy part. It's all like very well established. But I think when you're dealing with something that has second and third order downstream effects, you can't shake it too violently. And when it comes to the economy, you talk to anybody who does macroeconomics, like they're alchemists. They have a little bit of science, a little bit of magic, and they're trying to like read the tea leaves, but they actually don't understand these systems. It's like weather systems, right? You can understand some pieces of them. It's quite possible we could break things in the economy. And the thing that was going to break was, if he didn't relent, I was talking to all these startups who are in e-commerce specifically.
Yeah. No, I heard a lot from e-commerce. My brother-in-law is in e-commerce. Yes.
And they were we're going to have to do layoffs. We're going to not put our Christmas summer orders in. We are going to not do this new product line, and we're not investing in this new thing. It takes a decade, 5 years, you know, minimum 2 or 3 years to set up these supply chains and get a business cranking. So I was talking to Cuts Clothing, and I had him on the pod here in This Week in Startups, and he was like, I'm going to have – everybody in my group chat is laying people off. And I think they didn't fully realize exactly how this would go to mainstream. Like when Bessent was saying, this is a Mag 7 problem, not a mainstream problem. Yes. First stroke of the pen, it's a Mag 7 problem. It's a market problem. And then week 6, it would have been massive layoffs. And the Trump layoffs would have made him so hated – that his operating system is to be loved. So winning the deal, going and getting all these wins in the Middle East, which is kind of a superpower, I think, and then, the stock market comes roaring back. I knew he would reverse his entire position if it didn't go well.
Right. So look, I don't think either one of us can speak to exactly what was in his mind at that moment. Like, was his plan to throw out the bomb, have it be crazy for 3 days, and then have what happened happen? That seems right to me, but I'll grant you, maybe it was he was going to throw out the bomb, had no idea what was going to happen.
Yes.
I would say either way, since we can't speak to what's in his brain, what we can speak to is what has happened. And what has happened, I think you would agree, has been pretty good, right?
I mean,
we're going to, assuming we get the landings that we think we're going to get at the end.
It's possible he will, yeah, have more fair trade deals over time. Yeah.
I think the way I would put this is when I was first coming around to Trump, so this is now got to be 6 or 7 years ago. Do you know Eric Weinstein?
Yeah, of course.
So I had Eric on the show and he really, I was trying to get him to come along too. So sort of what I've been doing with Bill Maher for years, I've tried to bring these people along, right? And Eric just couldn't get there. He's a bull in a china shop. He's a bull in a china shop. And I said, Eric, well, the thing is, what you seem to want is a panther in a china shop. You want a panther to walk in and be real sly and knock one thing off with its tail and then just close the door softly on the way out. But that's not the phrase. And there's a reason it's not the phrase. It doesn't really exist. Would we all like in like our heart of hearts or in like if everything was as highly functional as we'd like it to be, would we like him perhaps to be more, now he's changed where I do think
presidential.
He is more statesmanlike. But could we have gone without some of that stuff? Sure. Could we have gone with some of that? Sure. But that's just not exactly how the world works. So we finally got one guy that was willing to do all of the things that none of us were willing to do. And to me, the results of that have been a net positive. So that's why when you asked me last night and you asked me here, like what's my criticism of him? I don't really have much.
You just look at the output.
At the end, I really do just look at the output. Could he have not tweeted this or that or some of those things? Like maybe, but he was also, now we see how calcified the mainstream media was, how he was working against big tech. I mean, in retrospect, the fact that the old regime of Twitter took him out and what they did to Parler. And when you think of just all of these things.
I would have given him a 30-day pause after January 6th, just because the chances of him, January 6th could have been hundreds of Americans killed. If those police officers had done what most police officers would have done, which is when you're getting beaten, you know, take the guns out and start shooting people, they showed incredible restraint. That could have been a much different outcome for America. Dave Rubin, I appreciate the hour.
It has been a pleasure. Now I have to figure out how to get you for the next hour. We have I'm going to talk to Lonsdale now. I got to think.
And then I'll see you over in the studio.
How can I get Jason?
No, you and I are probably the closest to center of everybody in our circles. We probably are the two people who are criticized most by our constituents of like, oh, wow, they won't like fully take one side or they're thoughtful about this stuff. Like I'm kind of disappointed in some of my friends that just have that Trump dedication syndrome.
Who had that great joke? I would never be part of a club that would have me. Whose joke
that
is
would
that?
Be, that's probably Marx Brothers.
Is that Marx Brothers? Oh, that's Groucho Marx.
Groucho Marx.
There you go.
Yeah, I remember. All right, everybody, we'll see you next time on This Week in Startups. Bye-bye.